on digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
How are you doing? Good doctor.
I'm very good, but can I start with an audience request?
You can.
Which is for use in a review later on in the show. Who can tell me what's the name of that horror film whose name I have completely forgotten, but which I would like to be able to drop casually into the review?
Is it The Exorcist?
No. Late 60s, early 70s, possibly Hammer, maybe Amicus, one of those sort of things. Cushing, Lee, probably, in which a scientist locates the viral root of evil. He discovers that evil looking under a microscope, and he then attempts to make a vaccine that vaccinates against evil, and he vaccinates his daughter, and you don't have to be a genius to figure out that the vaccine doesn't work, and his daughter, she turns bad. What's the name of that movie? Please, because I cannot remember.
Why should we help? Is there an incentive? Do we win anything?
Well, you'll be smarter than me because I can't remember it. And I've already rung Alan Jones and said, what's the name of that movie? And
isn't
he can't remember it either.
Being Dr. Horror, to know this kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So if you know, then therefore you've got one over on me and made me look silly. But I'll use it anyway. I mean, hey, I'll take information where I can get it. I just can't. I mean, the point is, I've got a 47-year-old's brain that no longer. It's in there somewhere, but I can't remember. What's the name of that film? Please let me know.
You can't remember anything else about it.
Who are you? Who are you? Are you that Mark Goodyear?
Almost certainly. Peter Powell, you can call me. So we have a couple of guests. Noel Clarke's going to be with us shortly. No, that was Alan Freeman did Pop Pickers, clearly.
I know.
Michael Winterbottom on The Killer Inside Me. Reviews of, amongst others, for example, on this email from Ruari, I think that is, Ruari Carroll. Dear Big and Aidan, can't wait to hear Mark's Sex and the City 2 review. As a man who took occasional pleasure in the TV show, I'm trying to wonder why they called the sequel Sex and the City, as there's no sex, and instead of a city, we're treated to the pleasures of the Arabian desert.
Right.
Being one of the few males in a female-dominated office, I made the mistake the other day of pointing out that the early reviews are really bad. I've been quiet ever since.
I should say, because I know there will be emails about this, there have been some early reviews which have just been, of the ones that I've read, have been universally appalling. There's one that many people have tweeted about. I think it's by Lindy West, which is, I mean, unrepeatably savage. So I should say,
maybe you could go against the grain.
I should say from the outset that there is really that it's amazing to see the amount of vitriol that Sex and the City 2 has already provoked. And there is really, this isn't a shouting competition. It's not to do with who shouts, but I have read a couple of reviews in which I have thought, blimey, Charlie, that's blistering.
From Regensburg, Germany, Owen says, dear product and placement, in light of the upcoming wailing, gnashing of teeth and general hand-waving that will no doubt be caused by the new Sex and the City abomination, in Owen's opinion.
Don't prejudge.
Can the good doctor give us an insight into how bad a film has to be before he refuses to even review it, or indeed go and see it in the first place? Has there ever been such an instance of a large release film where you have just refused to watch it?
No, I mean,
it would be a sackable offence, really, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you can't refuse to watch it. I mean, there is a problem at the moment, as you probably know, and with Bollywood movies, for example, Kites, the remix, it's to do with press screenings and them being press screened or not being press screened. What I attempt to do with movies that aren't press screened is to see them, you know, over the weekend, if that's possible. I haven't seen Kites, the remix, if anybody has.
I think this is more a kind of statement of principle.
No, but on a principle level, no, that's not the idea. My principle is always that I will only walk out of a film if it contains actual scenes of animal cruelty or actual scenes of child abuse or actual scenes of Julian Sands. But that's obviously a cheap gag, which I have to stop doing. But that is the only circumstance under which I'll walk out of a film. I was watching The Losers the other day, and there's a cockfighting scene in it, and I felt myself twitch for a minute. But then, of course, it had been through the BBFC, and of course the BBFC would automatically cut anything that involved actual cockfighting, so it was fine. But I mean, cockfighting I find really reprehensible, and the idea of it being in a sort of 12 certificate movie, you know, as a kind of casual pastime, I think is pretty annoying.
We'll review The Losers after 3. Tony Presley says, I was caught by the idea that Sex and the City have come up with the old staple of sending the cast on holiday together. The League of Gentlemen knew it was a tired idea when they threw it into their movie as a laughable, desperate idea. So Sex and the City 2 is basically a remake of Are You Being Served, the movie that
Oh, I hate you for doing that. That's what? It. Well, because I was going to. I've got it written down. But yes, Sex and the City 2 is a remake of Are You Being Served, in which they go off to the Costa Plonka. That's what it's called. And they go off to the Costa Plonka, and there is loads and loads of jokes about Mrs. Slocum worrying about her pussy, and that is basically Sex and the City 2.
Let's update you on the cricket, because there is a wicket for Pat Murphy. Afternoon, Pat.
Hello there, Simon. Graham Swan's gone for 22. Jolly little cameo. 13 balls it took him. He tried to sweep Shakib, the spinner, splendidly caught by Rubel just in front of the square leg boundary. Last pair together now, England 498 for 9. Remember, Jonathan Trott scored 226.
Will they be happy with that, Pat?
No, I don't think so. They were 400 for 5. They played a lot of shots lately. They were 227 for 2. I think they needed more than this. I think they'll win the game, Simon. They're much the better side, but the Bangladeshis have done well today, in my opinion.
Pat, thank you. We'll update you every 15 minutes and when there's a wicket, and it's ball by ball on 5 Live Sports Extra. Tony concludes his email by saying, what next? Friends go to Benidorm. Dear Robin Hood and
his
merry man...
They're not friends anymore, though, are they? Are they still friends? Haven't friends stopped being friends? Aren't they all now...
Who knows?
Mildly estranged.
Adam Igra, or possibly Igra, BA History First Class, MA International Relations, pending. Dear Robin Hood and his merry man, whilst visiting my excellent local independent and long-standing cinema, The Phoenix in East Finchley, to see the unfortunately average Four Lions, I was greeted by the evidence to put to bed, the debate surrounding the good doctor's magnificent mitts. There, embedded within the cement on the pavement, are imprints of Kermode's claws, which I must now announce, and to my somewhat disappointment, are in fact normal. I encourage all followers of Wittertainment to make the journey... pilgrimage, really, to North London and readjust their opinion on this important subject, and then take the opportunity to support a cinematic institution.
I'm very proud of that. I was being made an honorary whatever it is of the Phoenix, which is the cinema that I saw everything in. I mean, sort of like every movie I saw pretty much I saw in the Phoenix before I went to Manchester. And then they said outside, they said there's some wet concrete outside, because they were just fixing one of the steps. They said, would you put your hand in it? And I thought, oh, that'll be all right. What I hadn't realised is you have to push really hard to make any kind of imprint in wet concrete. So there's a very, very faint imprint of my hand. It's not very spectacular. It's not like Roy Rogers and Trigger outside Man's Chinese on Hollywood Boulevard.
Much conversation to come. We're awaiting Noel Clark's arrival. Then Michael Winterbottom will be joining us as well. Noel Clark is here. How are you, Noel?
I'm good, sir. Thank you for having me.
We started the programme with Mark asking for a little bit of information.
Yeah, I said, what was the name of that horror film? See what you can do. What was the name of that horror film from, I said, late 60s, early 70s, I thought it was a Hammer movie, in which a doctor discovers that evil is a virus, and then he attempts to turn the virus into an antidote, which he injects into his daughter with unsurprisingly bad results. No?
Never.
Okay, well, fine. Well, it was in my head, but so from both Alan Stevens and Andrew Wood, and I'm sure many others, but those were the first two I think. It's the creeping flesh.
I knew that.
Thank you very much. And when I drop that casually into the review, both Andrew Wood and Alan Stevens, that is the sound of me doffing my entire head to your greater knowledge.
Because you can doff a head.
I couldn't. Well, doff it.
I doffed my
quiff to Helen Mirren when I was down on one knee after having tried to explain to her what I meant when I thought, you know about this. Helen Mirren stopped me at the BAFTAs and said, what do you mean it's not a real film? And I attempted
to explain
myself.
You can imagine that might annoy her.
You see, but because you're the only one we care about.
No, don't say that. No, that's not
true.
No, it's not.
It's true.
You think Helen Mirren sits at home and thinks, I wonder what Mark Kermode thinks.
No, we do.
He rather liked Caligula.
It's true, sir. It's true.
Anyway, Noel is back because he has a new movie, which is called 4321.
4321, yes, indeed.
4.3.2.
Yeah, but the numbers all stand for something, though.
Indeed, they do. Is there a dot after the last one?
I guess there would be, yeah. Yeah.
Not
after the number, but after the word, yes.
What's the tagline?
It's 4 girls, 3 days, 2 cities, 1 chance. Dot.
Okay.
Did you know, coincidentally, that your film opens in cinemas the same day that the video of 1, 2, 3, 4 comes out in shops? Seriously.
There you go, man. It's a sign.
It's a sign, but what does it mean?
I have no idea.
No. If anyone would like to interpret that, that would be very nice. So you've hinted at where we are with 4321 with that tagline. Take us through the premise, Noel.
It's about four girls who sort of inadvertently get involved in a diamond heist and have to navigate their way out of it over a 3-day period while living their own lives and having their own separate dramas, you know, and it's just something different that, you know, a bit fun. I thought I'd try and do something a bit different than nobody else was doing, so...
don't just dismiss it like that. It's just a bit of fun. You make it sound like it's a piece of whimsy and it lasts half an hour and it's going to go out on BBC
Two. Can you make the word whimsy sound so damning? A piece of whimsy.
No, whimsy is lovely. I like
whimsy, but you say a piece of whimsy.
No, I mean, I love it. I'm very proud. Okay, look, I love it. I'm very proud of it, which I am, in all seriousness. But it definitely was, the latter part of that is, you know, not to be dismissed. It definitely was myself trying to do something different from the things that I had done before, as not to be put into a box of he does that.
But you tell the story. You mentioned the four girls, yeah. And we follow each girl in sequence.
Yeah, you follow each girl in sequence. So the whole film is told kind of, you know, not in chronological order. You follow each girl 4 to 3 days, then you jump back to a certain point, then you follow the next girl. And as each story is told, a little bit more of the looser story, the diamond heist, is revealed throughout.
Tell us about the girls who you've chosen and the characters that they play.
Right, well, we have the Lumsley. Yeah, the Lumsley, no. We have the lovely Tamsin Egerton, who from St Trinian's 1 and 2, who I've known a while, and she plays a posh girl called Cassandra, who goes off to meet a love interest abroad. We have Shanika Warren-Markland, who was one of the girls from adulthood, and she plays a feisty character called Keris, a relatively newcomer, but a girl I think is going to do extremely well, called Ophelia Loverbond, and that is a real name. She plays a girl called Shannon.
Ophelia Loverbond.
Ophelia Loverbond.
Can't be her real name.
It's unbelievable, right? But it is.
Sounds like the James Bond love interest.
It does, doesn't it? I've said that.
What's your name?
I'm Ophelia Loverbond.
Yeah. Right, good. Well, you're in then.
Yeah. And the young Miss Emma Roberts, who is a fantastic actress and has a bit of acting in her blood.
And there'll be a couple of moments where people go, hang on, I know who he is.
Yeah, as usual, I appear in the film. But you know, I'm an actor by trade, is what I've always wanted to do, and writing and directing came later. So you know, I'm in this film as well, but in a relatively small part, I think.
We have a clip of Noel in the film, in the relatively small part, of you being slightly obnoxious in the department store. In the store. You want to hear this?
In the convenience store.
Here we go.
So, what's your name, Sweetness?
Sweetness. Wow. Does that work for you ever?
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
Okay, well, my name is not Sweetness, I can assure you that. It is Joanne.
Right, well, I've never seen you on a late shift before. Joanne?
I usually work Saturday, 9 till 4, but haven't worked in a while. But, you know, gotta feed those kids, right? I know, I'm kidding. I don't have kids. I mean, I'm kid-free. Everything's all unpushed to get out, like. I'm just gonna stop talking.
Right, so you know your job's today, yeah?
I'm here to work, so whatever.
Good. So, clean the staff toilets and the customer toilets, then sweep and mop the floor. Then do a stock check and stock shelves 1 to 12. Start new displays for the items that aren't selling well in the places I've marked. Reprice the king-size sneakers and cash up register 1 and work on register 2, which will rotate until morning. Great. Oh, and hang up my jacket.
I bet that's what you were like as a director as well, wasn't it?
I am. They have to hang up my jacket every day when I come in. You know, and in fact, I'll put it on just so each time one of them comes in, they have to take it back off.
You are pretty obnoxious.
Yeah, I know.
Kevin Smith's here.
Yes, Kevin Smith does a cameo in the film. I'm a great admirer of his work, and we asked him if he'd like to be in the film, and he'd never been in a UK film, and he sent me an email saying, as long as I'm not topless or bottomless, I'm in.
But it's not just that he's in it, because because the script's been around for a while. It's that he's in it in a role which seems explicitly to refer to the fact that he recently had an altercation with an airline. Because the point is, we meet him on a on an airline, and he's a large gentleman, Kevin.
He's a buxom fellow.
And the altercation was that in real life, correct me if I'm wrong, he had a problem that there was one about whether
on an airline. Yeah, he got on the plane and they told him he was too large to be in the seat and had him removed from the plane. Weirdly, though, we shot this before any of that stuff happened.
So it was completely coincidental?
It was completely coincidental.
My only problem with that scene is that she, as we establish in the film, is unbelievably wealthy. She's been given a huge pocket load of cash by her very, very
rich parents.
But she appears to be an economy.
No, it's not economy.
It's not economy?
No, it's not. No, not at all.
Simon, you know that world that you live in? That's actually first class. I know it looks like economy to you, but actually it's first class. If you get on the plane and turn left, it's first class. Yeah.
If you have to squeeze past people into a seat in the middle, that doesn't look like an expensive seat.
No, it wasn't economy. I don't think that... They're in the first class seats at the end. I won't say too much, but that bit there is definitely not economy. It might be the premium economy. Yeah, I travel economy. I don't mind, you know.
Yeah, no, it's... Well, yeah. Obviously, it's only Lord Mayo over there who's never realised the real horror of an economy.
No, that is entirely unfair, because actually the opposite is true.
I don't have people bringing you champagne on trays either and saying, can I take your luggage for you, sir?
They do spend a lot of their time these girls, these women...
Oh, come on, before you say that, not all of them do.
Speaking the Queen's English.
Yes. Yeah, good. Yeah, and I knew that's what you were going to say.
What did you think I was going to say?
What
did you think I was going to say?
They do spend a lot of their time in their underwear.
Too much time in their underwear,
yeah.
Noel.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly.
Well,
yeah, I think possibly. But, I mean, the balance that we were trying to create was not disregarding or disrespecting the audience that we have brought along with us from the previous films, which is a very sort of laddie audience, but at the same time trying to do something that kind of respects and brings more girls into the film. So there was a fine balance of trying to, you know, honestly, I'm not going to say, oh, I don't justify. Honestly, it's trying to get a fine balance of, you know, empowerment of girls, but still bringing the boys through so they can go, you know what? I actually quite like that because of that bit there, you know, and that's the honest truth about it. You know, American films do that all the time, and it's not that I'm trying to just copy American films, but just trying to make something that appeals to the people we used to appeal to and appeals to new people as well.
I mean, I think that's apparent. I mean, it's interesting because when we met before and you said to me, you said, what did you think of it? I said, I didn't think you made it with a 48-year-old Ted in mind.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's not, you know, it's not for me. I'm a huge fan of yours, as yeah. you know, and I think you have great work ahead of you, and I remain
thank
thinking
you, sir.
But there was an interesting, I mean, I had problems with 4-3-2-1 in terms of the, you know, do we actually have to have the lesbian sex scene? Do we have to have because for me it felt like exactly what you said, that what you were attempting to do was keep that audience on board. Yeah. Here's what I think the interesting question will be, and I do appreciate that in this I am a 47-year-old Ted, and so consequently not so is what am I being stopping? I think the question will be, will young women seeing it feel empowered, yeah. or will young women seeing it feel as I do, like put your clothes back on? And I honestly don't know the answer.
I think I'll be at both of that.
This is Five Live. Mark Kermode, Simon Mayo, Noel Clark is with us. Michael Winterbottom joins us any second. But just before the news and sport, Mark,
yes.
you posed a question to Noel about his film about empowerment.
Yes, which is that I genuinely don't know what the answer is. But do you think that the young girls watching it will feel empowered by it, or do you think that as a 40-year-old, you know, aging old guy, will feel in any way bothered by it? And the reason I ask that question is this: there is an element of the movie that has exactly the same response to me as the Spice Girls. I know loads of people who genuinely love this film, genuinely felt yeah. empowered by the Spice yeah. Girls, and I could never see it at all. For, to me, it was just... And I ask yeah. you because I think that you're a smart guy, and I also think that your intentions are pretty good.
Yeah, no, of course, my intentions...
No, but don't take that as a given, because many people's intentions aren't.
Good,
so,
yeah, sure.
you know, the very fact that you raised that, you know, the balance between the lad and the...
You know, like I said, honestly, we tried to find the balance, yeah. you know, and I'm not ashamed to say that, because there's a big laddie audience from the previous films. But definitely, you know, I was raised by a single mother, and I believe in empowerment of, you know, strong women, and my mother's very strong, and, you know, I've got a strong wife, and the film is definitely a film that's supposed to say, you know, girls don't always have to be the damsels in the street. They can be they can save the boys for once. They can be the kick butt heroes, you know. And I do think girls will feel empowered by it. I wouldn't have done it otherwise. I do, you know. I'm sure there will be a few that aren't. But no matter what you do in life, anything you do in life, from my jacket, from your lovely quiff there, sir, you know, people are going to like it or they're not.
Sure.
So there's nothing you can do about it. But my intentions were to definitely get women to feel empowered, but at the same time, give our previous audience something that they can still relate to and look at, but broaden their horizons.
Joe, the film student in Staffordshire, says, Noel is, of course, known for being Mickey in Doctor Who. Is he aware that Emma Roberts' dad, Eric, once played the Master in a one-off Doctor Who TV movie in the mid-90s?
Yes, I'm aware. Of that. There yes,
go.
Indeed.
The connection. Noel, stay with us. Let me bring in Michael Winterbottom. He joins us. His latest film is The Killer Inside Me, starring Casey Affleck. It's out next week. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Hi there.
Are you Hello. Good, sir?
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Joining us from a radio car parked somewhere legally, I trust, as opposed to the radio
road.
Car on yesterday's programme, which got booked by the traffic.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. Hello, Michael, sir.
Hi there.
That's Noel Clark, Michael.
He knows me. We know.
Hi there, Noel. How are you doing?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
I hope they haven't been giving you a hard time with
no,
questions.
No. I don't, well, you know, I respect Mark. He's the only one I do care about, so, you know, I listen to him.
Yeah, and I bet when you're in the room with Boyd Hill, so you say you're the only one I care about.
Believe me, I don't. Trust me. Actually, it's water off a duck's back, usually. I only listen to you.
Right.
Noel's a great flatterer.
Yeah, he is. You're right. And he's working. He's working a charm. Michael, clearly the police are going to come and get you in just a moment by the sound of it. So let's talk about The Killer Inside Me, based on a 1952 Jim Thompson novel. Just set this up for us, Michael.
Well, it's the story of Lou Ford, who's a deputy sheriff in a small town in West Texas, and it's sort of, you know, it's about him and his rather violent kind of character.
Okay, and fill in the blanks, please, because there's a lot more going on than you're suggesting there.
Well, yeah, as you said, it's based on a Jim Thompson novel. I think it's a great novel. And really the beginning of the story is Lou Ford meets up with Joyce Lakeland, who's a prostitute that his boss, the sheriff, has asked him to move on. And really in the first five or six pages, you know, he meets her, she hits him, he hits her back, they make love. He sort of falls in love with her, but he also decides he's going to kill her. So that's like the first five or six pages of the book, and the book carries on from there, really.
And this is the book, if I've got this quote right, Michael, that Stanley Kubrick said, probably the most chilling and believable first-person story of a criminally warped mind I have ever encountered.
That's what it says on the cover, yeah.
Which kind of sets it up as, inherently, we're dealing with disturbing material here.
Yeah, it is dark material. I mean, Jim Thompson's a great writer, he's a kind of noir writer, so obviously all kind of thrillers, noir books, pulp fiction books, whatever you want to call them, they all deal with violence, they're very melodramatic. You know, and Thompson, you know, is a kind of very strong writer. I think he's a great writer. And, you know, I think there's another quote, I think it might be Stephen King, who says that Thompson sort of writes the unwritable and thinks the unthinkable. And he does take you to very dark places. But for me, after kind of reading the book as well, there's a lot of, it felt, what stayed with me was the tenderness. You know, he's writing about someone that a lot of people love, that has a lot of potential, and he sort of destroys all the possibilities for love himself because he sort of feels very insecure, very weak. He sort of hates himself in a way. So it's his kind of self-loathing that sort of creates the destruction. And actually, you know, Thompson writes a lot about the kind of the possibilities of tenderness and the possibilities of love that are kind of destroyed by Lou.
I think the key element here, and something which has clearly divided audiences, is in the treatment of the themes of violence, which we should say from the very beginning, they are a part of the movie, but they are not by any means all of the movie. My own feeling about it, and I saw Killer Inside Me just earlier this week, in which Michael was doing an onstage afterwards at the Curzon, and I thought that the Thompsonian tone of it is extremely impressive. I was there, funnily enough, with a guy called Pete Stanfield, who's a professor in this area, and said that he was really knocked out by just how much it takes the book and puts it up on screen. And Michael, you said something in that discussion, which was somebody was asking you about whether or not you felt that the murder scenes were extended too far. I mean, there is we see a very, very brutal murder, and one of which in which the lead character punches a woman to death, and the scene is distressing and hideous and repellent, and much of the audience turned away. I found I did the same thing myself, and you said yourself that actually that was the correct response, to portray this violence in a way that made people turn away. However, you then said, I think that the question of morality is, then it may be immoral to do the story in the first place, but once you've decided to do it, this is the only way to do it. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, that, I'm not sure.
I'm paraphrasing you incorrectly, but
well, I don't know. I may have just been expressing myself badly. I mean, I think it's a difficult choice about, you know, whether you want to do a story which is about violence in the first place. And I think also, you know, it's obviously there are a lot of things. It's perfectly legitimate for people to feel they don't want to see violence. They don't want to go to the cinema to see violence. I think that's perfectly acceptable. But I think what I was trying to say is that, you know, obviously lots of films deal with violence, you know, but murder, you know, is a staple of drama from Shakespeare onwards and way before. It's like, and films deal with violence all the time. And I think if you're going to take a moral approach to violence, if there's going to be sort of like, is this moral or not to show violence, then surely it would be more, the immoral way of showing violence is to show it as simple or easy or entertaining or the right thing to do. You know, and if you're going to pose a moral question about should there be violence in a film, then surely it's better to show violence for what it is, which is nasty and ugly and brutal and destructive. And in the case of The Killer Inside Me, it's very clear in Thompson's book, and I hope it's clear in the film, that Lou Ford is not a hero, he's not a role model. I don't really think there's any way you watch the film and think, oh, I want to be like Lou Ford and go around beating women. He's a character who's weak, who's been sort of emasculated by his father, lives in the shadow of his father. He still lives in his father's house, though his father's dead. He reads his father's books. He sort of wants to be his father, and he wants to destroy kind of his father. And really, I think it's clear that his violence comes from his weakness rather than from his strength.
I just want to mention that in the BBFC report, what it says is, although there are portrayals of strong sexual and sadistic violence and sadomasochistic behaviour, the scenes in question do not eroticise or endorse sexual violence or pose a credible harm risk to viewers of 18 and over. Sorry, Simon.
No, it's just my take on it, Michael, was slightly different to to Barks in that I found that I came out of it thinking it was a deeply misogynist film, because the violence to the men is brief and casual and throwaway. There's a hanging, you don't see it. It's a bullet in the head and it's all over. That's another character. The women in this film are there to be spanked or beaten to death. And then, I know this sounds odd but makes sense in the film, come back and ask for more. And if that isn't a misogynist film, I'm not sure what it is.
Well, I mean, as I say, when I read the book, kind of it seemed to me what I was left with afterwards, it was, you know, the effect of the book was for me sort of cathartic, you know, in the sense that you see this kind of very violent story. You see this character who does kind of want to destroy everything around him and finally destroy himself. But afterwards, you're not left kind of, you know, you're left kind of with those feelings purged from you, that you feel like actually, you know, you look around the world, at the world around you, and sort of try and, you know, think about it in a kind of way of like how to avoid those kind of emotions. And I think on the issue of the violence with the women as opposed to the men, I think what's important to remember is that the two important women for Lou the two important characters for Lou are the two women. You know, Joyce and Amy are central to the story. So that is why I think Thompson describes the scenes like as they're shown in the film. He describes them in a lot of detail and he makes them very brutal and shocking, because those two women love Lou and they love Lou in a kind of unconditional way. So it's particularly kind of awful that he chooses this kind of brutal, intimate way of killing them. You know, so I think the reason, you know, certainly from my point of view, the reason that those are the key scenes in the film is because those are the important emotional relationships. You know, what he does to the stranger in town, what he does to the boy, is far less important and central to the story. It's about someone wanting to kill anyone who's close to him. He wants to kill people who give him the possibility of happiness, the possibility of love. And so those are the two crucial scenes, because those are the two people who kind of love him unconditionally.
Because I think that this debate will rumble on. And as Simon said, you know, we feel very differently about the film. May I move this on to something else, which is that I was very interested in the music in the film. And there's a moment very early on in which we see the central character driving down the road listening to One Hand Loose. And of course, there is, it seemed to me, a very knowing use of music. Music which often is music played by people who have come from situations of extreme domestic violence, many of whom have been in prison, and also has that strange thing between that hillbilly feel that there is a very thin line between horror and humour. How do you feel about that?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, it's something that Thompson has as well. Thompson has a sort of laconic kind of humour in his stories, and the music, you know, which is, you know, a lot of the music in the film is kind of from that period and from that place, you know, sort of Texas swing and in that area. As you say, it's sort of things that, you know, deal with kind of, you know, all the kind of usual subjects, difficult subjects that music deals with, and as you say, by people who kind of may well have had those experiences, but it has a kind of very bright kind of quality to it, enjoyable quality to it, humorous quality to it. And I mean, it seems to me that was good for being right for the feel of the film, but also I think it's one thing that it was kind of good for me from Lou's point of view, because kind of Lou is senior as being this kind of person who has a kind of mad view of the world. He doesn't have a normal way of connecting kind of different emotions and different ideas together. So, you know, at the same time that he decides he wants to kill Amy, for instance, he also realizes he loves her, and yet he's unable to kind of make the connection that somehow that would therefore be a crazy thing to want to kill her. There's a sort of alternation, you know, between different moods, which I also wanted to get in the music. So you have this light-hearted music, and then also you have the kind of the sort of much more romantic music of his father's, of Marla and people like that.
There's a question which is posed by Rachel Cook, who was writing in The Observer last weekend, Michael, which essentially boils down to, and we've heard what you've said about the movie, do you have any idea how offensive many people will find this film?
Well, the thing is, it's like, I mean, as this, I think, I mean, from there's a different, this is quite a complicated issue to talk about, but I think if you're saying that you can't show violence towards people, and or specifically you can't show violence towards women, I think that is wrong. You know, there clearly is violence in the world, and there clearly is violence towards women in the world. I don't think you can therefore say that films or books shouldn't deal with it.
So for me,
the issue is, when I read the book, did I feel it was a misogynistic book? Did I feel the violence towards women in the book was somehow encouraging that violence? No, I didn't. And I don't personally think the film does. I think there are lots of films that show casual violence towards women, which may well make it seem glamorous or exciting or fun, but The Killer Inside Me, in my opinion, certainly is not one of those. You know, there's no way you can watch that and think that is something that is being endorsed, condoned, promoted. And I think it's showing, actually, about how how pointless violence is. You know, that's for me the tone of Thompson's book, is that it's a kind of sadness about how someone destroys the possibilities of happiness.
I think this does draw us back to things like, for example, the argument that surrounded Irreversible, the Gaspar Noé film, in which there's the 9-minute assault sequence, which is repulsive. And actually, that's the point. The point is that it's, you know, it's there for that long because it's that horrible.
No, you're right. It's that horrible. And I think it harks back, you know, comments like that hark back to the previous films that that I've done as well, where they're saying that they're glamorizing violence when in real life, if you get hit with a bat, you might die. That's what happens in the first film. That's real life. And how's that glamorizing violence? Glamorizing violence would be he got hit with the bat, got up, pushed me through the front door, we fought, smashed through a window. That's glamorizing violence. And I think that if you can't show things that happen in the real world, in your art, in your films or whatever, then what's the point?
One thing that's very interesting is that this has actually prompted a proper debate about the nature of screen violence. I mean, it's funny how I remember Michael was saying that at very very early screening in Sundance, the very first question was, somebody said, how dare you and how have they put this film on? And actually, my feeling is that anything that causes that debate to be had is in itself, you know, an interesting and probably progressive thing.
But that's what you want. You want people to come out of your piece of work and talk about it.
Michael, did you know this this intelligent debate which Mark is talking about, that this would happen as a result of your film? Did you expect it or are you surprised by it?
It wasn't the reason I made it. You know, I mean, I made the film because I think it's a great book, and I was hoping to capture some of the qualities of the book in the film. I mean, obviously, the scenes that we're talking about, you know, were intended to be shocking, but you know, I was a little bit surprised, not so much by people who are shocked by the scenes, that's, I think they should be, but there was a kind of almost, in my opinion, kind of confused link between the fact that if something's shocking and horrible, it is therefore immoral, without kind of examining, well, actually, in what sense is it advocating something which is wrong? You know, it seems to me it's the opposite, it's sort of showing what's wrong. So I was surprised by that continuation of the argument.
Michael Winterbottom, are you a cricket fan?
I'm not really, I'm afraid.
So good. That's that was an impressive 90 seconds of radio. Michael, what are you working on next after this? What's your next project?
We're hoping to do a film set in Palestine in the 1930s about two British police chasing a kind of Jewish underground kind of terrorist group led by a guy called Avraham Stern.
Sounds cool. Are we going to talk about how every time you give me a lead part in a film, it doesn't happen?
Yeah, so I know. We just can't get the finance when you're in the lead. I think they're wrong.
I've had two major parts in his films, and every time it ends up being the one film that doesn't happen.
Is that right?
Yes, people don't know that. Me and Michael,
we keep trying to work together, but
yeah. Yeah.
Can I would just like to say, you know, because obviously I'm not on next week when the film's going to be reviewed because it's half term. I just want to say that I do think that in terms of the tone of the Thompson novel, getting that on screen, there is really an achievement in doing that. And I think that despite the fact
my point is that most people they haven't read the book, they don't know what a Thompson novel is all about.
But what I was going to say was, I think although this discussion is very important and I think it needs to be had, it would be wrong to imagine that it is anything other than a part of the film. And I think one of the problems is, and I think to some extent, you know, Michael talked about this when the film was at the Curzon, is that an element of the film comes to overshadow the whole thing. And my own feeling is, I think there are opinions on both sides. I mean, I know people who think, I mean, Nigel Floyd, you said, felt, you know, similarly. That is one element of the film, and it is not the whole film. And regardless of how you feel about that particular element, I think there are other things that need to be taken. I mean, obviously, I think it's unavoidable that this has happened, and I think it's good that it's happened, but I think that shouldn't overshadow the rest of the movie. I just wonder from your point of view, Michael, whether you worry that this has, in many ways, become the thing that people talk about, as opposed to the music, as opposed to the performances, as opposed to the cinematography, as opposed to the getting that distanced tone on screen.
A little bit. I mean, it was interesting because, you know, as you said, we showed it at Sundance first of all, and that kind of argument started there. We showed it at Tribeca more recently, and Casey Affleck and Kate and Jessica were there as well. And then what's nice about that is then suddenly the conversation becomes more about the film and more about the performances and more about the characters. You know, so I mean, I think maybe, you know, I think obviously it is kind of frustrating from that point of view. But obviously, the violence is a central element of the film, but it's about violence as a destructive thing. There's also a lot of tenderness and there's a lot of love, as I say. And just to go back briefly to the violence, I mean, the second scene, that, you know, people often talk about two scenes, but then they really only talk about one scene. What's interesting is, I think, the second scene where Luford kills Amy.
It's every bit as horrible.
It's every bit as horrible, but it's not it's not violent in any kind of graphic sense. It's two punches. What's what's horrible about it is the emotions, and it's about the film is the story of Luford. He tells you the story as well, so he's in every scene and he's really telling you his own story. So I think part of it is the sort of the claustrophobia being with Luford, this guy who's got this kind of crazy view of the world and has this kind of violent element to him.
I think it's
the emotions rather than the actual physical violence that people are finding strong. You know, it's not, it's Casey's performance, it's about the weirdness of the situation. It's not, if you think about it, two punches, I mean, how many scenes have got way more graphic violence than that? It's not about a kind of graphic violence, it's about who Lou is and as a character. And I think if you're saying you can't deal with characters who have got violence in them, then that's, I think that's just, you know, wrong, and obviously films do all the time.
Yeah. Michael Winterbottom, appreciate you speaking to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Noel Clarke here, 4321 is his movie. This from Keir Husband. Just wanted to say thanks to Noel for being so nice to my son Brody, who did a few days as a picked child on Centurion. As a huge Doctor Who fan, he couldn't believe his luck on his first professional acting job.
No problem at all. I try to be as pleasant as I can generally. So
was Centurion fun?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. Yeah.
Wandering around in great, because it's Neil Marshall who great fun director.
He was on a few weeks ago.
But David Morrissey said that he showed his one of his family a picture of himself in Centurion, and there was so much blood on him that he didn't recognise.
It was fun. It was fun. I mean, we were put through the mill. Neil really, you know, when we were running, There was no like stunt. Well, there was stunt doubles, but most of the, I'd say 90%.
You leapt into the stream yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, no, we weren't allowed to leap, but from the cliff. But me and JJ Field did leap from the small bit into the freezing water and get washed down the stream. Yeah, indeed. And JJ got hypothermia, and I got frostbite.
And you said that you got that role because you won that Rising Star Award, and it was like the next day you got the call.
Yeah, I was kind of offered it the day before, but I think that's part and parcel of the job. You know, sometimes you're hot, sometimes you're not. You have to deal with it. You know, I went maybe 7 years without being, you know, getting any offers at all, wondering how come I never get any offers, and all of a sudden then, you know, I got quite a few in a row. It's just the nature of the beast.
Explain how you direct a film in association with somebody else.
It's 4321, co-directed with Mark Davis, is a buddy of mine. I mean, most co-directing gigs are done by brothers, right? You know, I've known this guy for 11 years. If you look at, if anyone actually, and this isn't referring to you guys, if people do their research and look at my first job, Metro Sexuality, he's the editor. You know, and that's like 11, 12 years ago. And I've known him ever since then. He's done a short film called Plastic, which I helped. I've known this guy for forever. We've plotted and planned and meticulously gone over this film for like years. So by the time we actually got to the point of filming, it's like there wasn't a scene. You know, people say, how was it? There wasn't a scene where he said, well, let's do that upside down. And I said, no, what are you talking about? We'd planned it. We'd been planned, storyboarded. You know, obviously, as the draft went through, you know, changes, we'd sit down together and, you know, for hours on end and do that. So essentially it's that simple.
My favourite scene in the film, and I forget the names of the characters, but it's in New York.
Right.
And one of the obnoxious guys gets his comeuppance when he's done. Right. And he gives out some racist chat.
He does.
And he is sort of like his final words are, I voted for Obama. That's a great sequence. Who is that? Now, who did you cast as that woman who confronts him?
The woman who confronts him is a girl called Eve Jeffers, and she's a rapper known as Eve. And she read it and just loved what the character had to say and decided to do it. And I think a lot of people get a laugh out of that scene, and especially him trying to get out of it by saying the Obama line.
Well, of course, you were the guy who, when they accepted his award, said, and I'd just like to say, yes, we can.
Yeah, exactly.
Mark Kermode is here. Noel Clarke is here as well. 4321 is his movie. Thank you very much, Steve. The emails to this one from Anthony. Dear Andy Peters and Sarah Green, my wife.
Can I be Sarah Green, please?
My wife and I found ourselves sitting directly behind Mr. Kermode at the Curzon Soho screening of The Killer Inside Me on Monday evening, which is what we were just talking about with Michael Winterbottom.
When I was there with Pete Stanfield.
This is really to the heart of the controversy. Having come straight from work, I had cheekily smuggled a sandwich into the cinema with the intention of scoffing it during the trailers. On discovering there were no trailers, due to it being a fancy preview screening type thing, I was faced with the choice of either sitting through the film thinking about my sandwich or eating the sandwich and risk being referred to by the good doctor as the annoying, noisy muncher who spoiled the film. I chose the former. Luckily, we did have some legitimately purchased popcorn as well. Never have I tried so hard to manoeuvre a foodstuff into my person without creating too many vibrations. I hope I succeeded. As for the film, it was all right. For me, it suffered greatly from expecting the audience to pick up the clues of the killer's past. Having not read the book, I felt like I needed to be given a lot more information to gain any kind of insight into the character. There were a few clues, but it sounds like the book offers a lot more, and without that, the protagonist becomes just another cold-hearted nutter. Anyway, while Noel is here, we need to just address the fact that you've made this film, to ask what you're working on next, because clearly it won't be a Michael Winterbottom film, because however much he tries to cast you.
Yeah, every time.
How many times has that happened?
Twice.
And then what were the two projects?
One was Goal. The film Goal was going to be myself, Diego Luna, Alison Lohman, before it became the film it eventually was.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's right, because of course he was down to do that.
It was a Michael film. 8 weeks I trained on that. And then he was doing a Manchester gangster film, which I was going to be the lead in.
And what happened to that?
Just kind of, it was, the recession happened, I think.
I don't think the recession knocked out Manchester gangsterism, though.
No.
Well, I would pay to see a Michael Winterbottom film with you as a Manchester gangster. I think that's a very good idea.
Yeah, we've tried to work together a few times, but those are the main two, and it just hasn't quite.
We should remember that Winterbottom did the definitive Manchester film in 24 Hour Party People, which remains for me the great document of that period. As somebody who lived through at least some of it,
as I believe you've told us a number of times.
Yes, but never knowingly undersold, Simon.
What are you working on next, Noel?
Apart from obviously 4321, which is out on the 2nd of June, plug.
Is that Wednesday?
Yep,
Wednesday. It'll be Wednesday.
It'll be a Wednesday.
Excellent.
Yeah, there's a nice Wednesday thing going on there. Go see that. There's a few things we're working on. I mean, I can't really go into too much detail. But again, each project I try and do will while staying true to the fans, will try and be a little bit different from not only my previous one, but hopefully from anything else that's out there. So that's really the plan. You know?
And I wonder if your kid's saying, come on, Dad, how about something that I can watch? None of this adult nonsense.
He kind of is, by the fact that all he ever wants to do is watch Elmo or Gruffalo or Toy Story. So I'm thinking, you know, there are plans. I've mapped out a kid's feature, which is mapped out head to toe on a Word document. I just haven't written the actual script yet. And I have been talks a couple of times with one Mr. Serkis about his motion capture.
Imaginarium, which is just beginning. This is Andy Serkis starting they don't call it motion capture, they call it performance capture.
There you go.
The performance capture studio.
Can't get with the current film terminology, you know, Noel, otherwise nothing will happen.
I'm a dinosaur already.
Do you want to do the box office top 10 with pithy comments from you and observations if you've seen any of it?
As long as I'm allowed to, sure.
Or are we going
to allowed to, Noel, yes.
Are we going to full foul? You know, is it going to be, I can't say anything rude about that because I'm going to be working with them?
No, I haven't actually, to be honest, looking at these.
You haven't seen any of them?
I haven't seen any of them.
Any of them?
No.
Just make it up then, Noel.
Right? There's no point. But let's go through it then.
Well, what might you be able to contribute if you haven't seen any of them?
My thoughts.
Great. Okay, that's sort of...
You see?
He's a seer.
He's a seer.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
Okay.
Okay, so number 10 is The Backup Plan.
Rubbish. Utter rubbish.
Who's in that?
It's the story of Jennifer Lopez.
Nonsense, nonsense.
Oh, fine.
Yeah.
there we go.
Yeah.
See, why aren't I allowed to do that?
Bad Lieutenant at 9.
I think it is a whimsical Werner Herzog movie. I don't quite understand why it's been lavish with quite the great reviews that it has been over here. There is a very strange relationship to the Ferrara original, which is a much tougher film to watch and a much nastier film, but has much meatier substance. But I love Herzog, and I would say, you know, Herzog and Nick Cage together are always an impressive thing. Not quite enough iguana shots for me.
Gotcha, I ain't seen it at all.
Did you see the original, the Abel Ferrara Bradenton?
No.
That is a tough film. I mean, that is a Catholic redemption guilt fest, you know, and then
every time I'm with this guy, I feel like I haven't seen any films when I'm with
him. But clearly, I haven't made any films, you know.
And on this email, I'm stuck in something of a dilemma. Wondered if you have the kindness to help me out, please. Everywhere I look and listen, I'm being told that Herzog's Bad Lieutenant is a film I must see. It's now in the top five, now showing list of most film critics in every broadsheet newspaper. I feel as though I need to see this film. However, the issue arises because I don't see Nicolas Cage films. This is a lifestyle choice similar to being a vegetarian or not drinking alcohol. I choose to not see films that star Nicolas Cage. I once saw 10 minutes of Ghost Rider purely by accident while flicking through the TV channels, and it's left me emotionally scarred and has led to my condition, which I have chosen to term let's call it Nickagophobia. That'll work. So I'm looking for some way to be persuaded to see Bad Lieutenant that won't bring me out in hives afterwards, or worse still, won't leave me wanting to watch The Rock Con Air, National Treasure 1 and 2, or any other bad Nick Cage films afterwards?
Well, the Nick Cage film that actually you should have seen is Leaving Las Vegas, which is his great performance.
That is a great film, yeah.
He's also terrific in Peggy Sue Got Married. That's a really good comedy performance in that film. You don't like it?
Yeah, I don't mind it. I actually quite like The Rock, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah. But it's a Michael Bay movie produced by Jerry Brooker.
Yeah, but Michael Bay before he was Michael Bay.
Yeah, exactly. No, that is true.
When they were still acting in the films.
Yeah. Scarlett Christie McKenna, listening in Sydney. Bad Lieutenant. New Orleans is the most fun... Bad Lieutenant, port of call. New Orleans is the most fun a human being can have with his pants on. It is the most over-the-top, darkly and likely hilarious, totally deranged film I've yet seen in the cinema. Herzog sprinkles his madness through the film through such innovations as Iguana Cam, and Nicolas Cage delivers a performance so over-the-top that the audience I saw it with broke into applause after a particularly hammy scene as if they were musical numbers. This movie is what Robin Hood should have been, pure innocent joy.
I just said the punctuation of that is Bad Lieutenant, New Orleans, Port of Call is the most... Port of Call, New Orleans is the most... Not Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call. New Orleans is the most fun.
Ollie in London. This is the very first time I've been to a film and walked out early. It was awful in every sense of the word. For the hour I saw anyway, because there was no story, no interesting characters, had no entertainment value and contained nothing at all that made me relate to what was happening on the murky and soiled screen. It's 1 hour of my life I won't get back. Anyway, he then went to see Leaving Las Vegas and he loved that.
Yeah, Leaving Las Vegas is great.
So, Hot Tub Time Machine at 8?
Not as funny as it ought to be with that title.
Go on, Noel, that's your moment.
Yeah, it looks mildly amusing, but that's about it, really.
What, just based on the title?
Just based on the trailer, looks kind of mildly mean, but I wouldn't pay to go and see it.
Nightmare on Elm Street at number 7.
It's just evil, and, you know, how dare they do this to a great horror movie? It's just like, let's hold it down, let's lobotomise it, let's take out all the good ideas, let's crank up all the gore. Michael Bay is the executive producer. It's rotten to the core.
But it's still Freddy, it's Freddy.
No, but it's not Freddy, that's the whole thing. It is Freddy, but it's not Freddy.
Gotcha.
It's not Freddy, that's the...
Has he got the hands with the claws?
He has, but it's Freddy. On that basis, Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is a Freddy film. And it isn't. Nightmare 1, yes. Nightmare 2, no. Gotcha. Nightmare 3, Partial Return. Then nothing at all until Wes Craven's New Nightmare. There are three proper Freddy films. 1, 3 and New Nightmare.
Gotcha.
Heard it here first.
I stand corrected.
Yeah. You certainly do.
Tread very carefully in this area, right?
Four Lions is at 6.
I like it very much, but it's not... What's interesting is when I said it's not that funny, that's not a criticism. It's actually profoundly melancholic and I thought moving.
It's an interesting film, and I think obviously the humour hides the actual deep stuff that's going on there about, you know, young Asian men in society today. And yeah. I mean, I'm slightly biased. I got two friends in the film, so... You know, I'll always... You know, that's probably why I saw it. But, you know, I think it's an interesting and good film.
Kites is at 5.
No, which I haven't seen. I was in Cannes last week. There's been complaints about me not... One of the problems is that a lot of Bollywood movies aren't press screened in advance. I'm not actually sure what the case was with this. Obviously, Brett Ratner is involved with this because it's Kites Remix. But I will go and see this weekend. I was in Cannes, as you know, last week, but I will go and see this weekend. But if anybody wants to email in a review, please do.
Haven't seen it.
So we have Iron Man 2 at 4.
Well, you know, the Gwyneth Paltrow stuff with him and Robert Downey is fine. Mickey Rourke is fine. The hitting each other with giant robot suits on is a bit boring. I mean, it needs a good edit, but it's, you know, there's 40 minutes of fun.
No, we got... There's a lot of...
It's Iron Man.
Yeah, and it's the second one.
Yeah, which I'm sure is not as good as the first.
Well, actually, you know, it's kind of pretty much the same. Is that there's 40 minutes of blah, 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 good stuff, and then there's, you know, an hour of people hitting each other dressed up as robots. But, you know, as you said, it's Iron Man.
There's a lot of correspondence about Iron Man 2 and Robin Hood still, but what I want to do is skate over that briefly, say thanks to Noel, because we've got to do Sex and the City 2 and do the other releases, so we'll come back to some of the correspondence if there's time.
Okay.
So Robin Hood's at 3.
Oh, blimey, Mary Poppins, I'm Russell Crowe.
Oh, really?
I'm doing an English accent, begorra, begorra. But occasionally, by echoes like Argyle to the foot of our stairs, it goes with a little tour around the British Isles.
Okay. What was that last one?
Leprechaun talk, that was.
That's right.
Yeah. That accent is just...
Paddy O'Hood. Prince of Persia at 2.
You know, it's better than Pirates of the Caribbean.
Street Dance in 3D, a box office sensation. It's number one.
I liked it.
It's always this Street Dance, you know, is the epitome of a genre that was created possibly by a film that I did a few years back. And has opened, you know, an audience. There's an audience there that was untapped before, and this film has capitalised on that, and I have nothing bad to say about it.
Are you taking the credit?
No. I'm just saying possibly. It's ambitious. It shows the city the way the city should be shown, so it can compete with any other city in around the world, and this will sell internationally, and I'm really glad that it's done well.
Do you think, just final word on 4321, do you think it will sell internationally? Do you think that
4321 is selling internationally? Yeah. It's a lot more commercial than the previous two films. It falls in the same sort of genre as this street dance thing. It's a film coming out of the UK that has an ambition to travel. It won't travel everywhere, but not many films do. But you know, the idea is that it broadens the horizons of the audience we have, much like this film does, and hopefully people see that.
There's a Q&A with Noel at The View Westfield in London's W12 at 6:30
tonight
on Monday.
Monday.
On Bank Holiday Monday, and yeah. Presumably you chose that cinema, which is just over the road from here, because that's where the sort of the key scene right at the beginning of the film, where all the girls Indeed. Come out of the yep, coffee shop yeah. and they're on the steps. That's just down the road.
We were the first movie to shoot in Westfield.
Can anyone turn up?
Bring your Rotten Tomatoes. So I'll be on the.
That's in London.
I'll be there. But yeah,
no. Always good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for having me, sir.
Thank you for coming
Thank
in.
You very
when
much.
Your kids' film is out, come and talk to us again.
I will do.
This is Five Live. Loads of emails on all kinds of films, but obviously we need to do all the reviews. We need to allow a bit of space for Sex and the City too. How do you want to do this, Mark? What's going to do?
Well, let's try and do Tooth Fairy and Wreck before half past. So Tooth, is that okay?
Yeah, and that's Wreck 2.
Wreck 2.
Yes.
Well done. Thank you. So Tooth Fairy, which you've probably seen the posters for, stars The Rock, or I believe Dwayne The Rock Johnson, I think, is to give him his full name. There's a thing, basically, if you're a Hollywood muscle man, if you're a sort of, you know, a movie muscle man, there is a progression from making sort of violent adult-orientated movies towards, as you get older, progressing towards the kids' market. I mean, you see, for example, Schwarzenegger did it with things like Kindergarten Cop, although actually, oddly enough, Kindergarten Cop is a 15 certificate over here. And then, you know, I think most famously, Jackie Chan has pretty much parlayed his entire act now into being a kids' entertainer. You know, Jackie Chan is very big with kids through the line of comics. If you watch kids' TV on CBBC, there's the, you know, the Jackie Chan, Jackie Chan thing. And now, of course, this is the way that The Rock has to go, having made sort of, you know, kind of action-y movies for teenage audiences, now aiming for a younger audience. Recently, he was in Escape to Witch Mountain, which, well, I kind of thought was fine. I liked it. I mean, I liked the original. It's got a slightly creepy feel to it, but I thought it was okay. Now, it's another one since then. Now, Tooth Fairy. Story is, he's a hockey player who's called the Tooth Fairy because he's gone through the prime of his career, and he's now, his main function is ice hockey player. His main function is to take other players out, and in doing so to knock out their teeth, hence he becomes a tooth fairy. He is dating a single mom with kids, which has become the default setting for these movies now. There's a guy and there's a single mom with kids. I mean, if you look at the most recent Jackie Chan movie, the one in which he turned out to be a spy, he's dating a single mom with kids. Well, this time it's Ashley Judd with kids, and what he has to do is he has to win over the kids in order to win the hearts of the single mom. That's the way it works. It's weird. It's become, you know, the Disney movies always used to be that it was a broken home, there was some kind of family trauma, that's the thing. Well, this is now man dates single mom with kids. And very early on in the film, he's playing a poker match with his friends. One of the kids has lost a tooth. Ashley Judd has put a dollar under the kid's pillow. He needs a dollar, so he goes upstairs, nicks the dollar, and having the intention of putting it back, doesn't put it back. She comes home. Kid says, oh, where's my dollar? And he is about to say, well, actually, you know what, kid? There is no such thing as a tooth fairy. At which point, he gets his comeuppance, which is he has to become a tooth fairy. And he goes to Tooth Fairy Land, where he meets the uber queen of tooth fairies, played by Julie Andrews.
You, sir, are guilty of disseminating disbelief, killing dreams, committing first-degree murder of fantasy, which by
Wait a minute. Is this because of what happened with Tess?
Excuse me. I hadn't finished speaking. Did I look as though I had finished speaking?
You know what? I don't know. Everybody's got British accents around
here. You just interrupted me again while I was admonishing you for interrupting me. Do I not look official enough? I don't understand why policemen or firemen don't get interrupted, but you add a pair of wings and suddenly all manners go out the window. Shouldn't you be more in awe of somebody with wings than without? You have no idea what I'm capable of. I could just fly up into the air and do something crazy. Maybe I breathe fire. You don't know.
Julie Andrews as the Queen of the Tooth Fairies.
Just being Julie Andrews.
Just being Julie
really.
Andrews, exactly. I mean, on the good front, Stephen Merchant plays the wingless sidekick who has to get The Rock through his training and turn him into a proper Tooth Fairy. And Stephen Merchant gets all the laughs, all the good lines, and all the, I suppose, the grown-up goodwill. It's not very good. It's fairly shoddily put together. The Rock does not have great comic timing, it has to be said. There's also a fundamental plot flaw. I mean, I hate to bring this up. I mean, obviously it refers back to movies like The Santa Claus. Remember that Tim Allen movie, which I said the third part of it was like tertiary syphilis. There's a fundamental plot problem here.
You're quoting yourself again. I always like that when we get
one of two things happens, right? Either the money that comes under your pillow is put there by your parents, as Ashley Judd is doing, or there's tooth fairies. If the money is put there by your parents, then there aren't tooth fairies. If there are tooth fairies, then why is Ashley Judd putting the money under the pillow? And why is it that when he gets sent out into the world being a tooth fairy, he doesn't constantly come across parents putting the money under their children's pillow and being surprised by there being a tooth fairy? I mean, I hate to say it, but if you're going to do this kind of thing, can you please be consistent? There either are tooth fairies or it's your mum and dad. Now, I don't know which one is true, but the movie seems to accept both truths in a way which is rather problematic. So it's all very well for Julie Andrews to say you are accused of killing dreams. But say the scriptwriters are accused of getting their metaphorical
knickers in a twist.
Thank you for finishing that.
There are some actors who, when you meet them, there are very few actually, who are just genuinely so delightful that you wish them well and hope that their next projects are really successful.
Was Dwayne The Rock Johnson one of them?
Well, he was. I mean, Tom Hanks was one. Michelle Ryan, who's actually in Noel's film, is another. But I vividly remember The Rock coming into a programme we were doing down at Westminster, so it was a Wednesday show, and he came in and he was thoroughly wonderful with everybody, all the kind of political hacks looking around saying, blimey, that looks like The Rock. Yes, it is The Rock. And he came in and he spoke to kids on the phone and he was utterly charming. So, you know...
Oh, well, good for him.
Respect to him. So I'm kind of wishing him well.
No, really. That's fine. I mean, you know, in that case...
Is he sort of okay? Apart from his comedy timing?
He's not very
and
good.
And the plot problems?
No, he's not very good.
And the fact he's not very good, apart from the fact he's not very good. Is it okay?
It's not as good as Escape from Witch Mountain, and it's not as good as Walking Tall for the more grown-uppy audiences. I mean, I've got, you know, he's not very good. But having said that, Jackie Chan, who wrestles with the language sometimes, I think has a more charming screen presence. The other thing, a question I have is this. What's with the Fender branding, right? Because there's a whole plot point, which is that Ashley Judd and the children, Ashley Judd is a single mum with a child, the old child is a kid, right, who at the beginning is seen playing a blue Fender Strat, okay? And The Rock has to come along and tell him that actually, you know, he's got a chance of rocking out with his blue Fender Strat. And then when The Rock is playing ice hockey, there's lots of Fender branding behind him, behind the goal. And then at a crucial moment in the film, the kid Blake breaks the blue Fender Strat. And then there's a magical moment in which the blue Fender Strat is replaced by a red Fender Strat. And I'm thinking they're going, sorry, have Fender... I have nothing against Fender Stratocasters. I have a blue Fender Stratocaster that was bequeathed to me by Stephen Fellows of the Comsat Angels, and I love them to pieces, but it was the weirdest bit of product placement I've seen in quite a long time. It's a very average film, and I think that generally parents will not find enough to keep them involved. It's not as good as Escape 2 from In Witch Mountain. I can't remember which word they use in the middle of
it
that.
It doesn't matter. Squeeze a quick one in then before the news.
Well, I'll say very quickly, Wreck 2, right? Well, the original Wreck, you know, which is a fantastic Spanish movie, Wreck as in R-E-C,
and it's got square brackets.
Square brackets, okay. And the original, which is now, it was remade as Quarantine, the American version, which wasn't very good. The original Wreck was a really good example of how you can do that stripped-down found footage thing. The story was that there's a woman presenting a television programme called While You're Asleep, and it's basically, they go to a fire station just to see what people do while you're asleep, and nothing happens, and nothing happens, and nothing happens. This is all filmed. Then they get a call to go to an apartment block. They go to an apartment block. The minute they get there, the apartment block is shut down and quarantined, because it turns out that in the apartment block, there is a crazies-like virus running amok and turning people into zombies. This, incidentally, clearly refers back to The Creeping Flesh, which I was asking about earlier on. Okay,
I remember that
now,
film.
And it's a really interesting film because it spends such a long time building up the characters that by the time people start dropping off, you know, it's really quite scary. The problem with Wreck 2 is that it picks up exactly where the last one ended, and it begins at a point of screaming terror. You know that guy Michael Bolton? You know Michael Bolton, the singer. Big problem with Michael Bolton's version of Yesterday, right? Is it goes like this: it goes Yesterday. Where are you going to go from there? By line two, you're on 11.
He peaked too early.
Exactly. Well, Wreck 2 peaks before the opening credits. So whereas the first one starts slow, and then builds up to this screaming terror, Wreck 2 begins from the second line of Yesterday, as sung by Michael Bolton, and then proceeds to carry on at this level all the way through in Spanish. Also, the vaguely exorcist-y subplot, which is introduced in the final reel of Wreck, becomes essentially the plot of Wreck 2, which is about a virus which is evil, which is something you've seen before in films such as The Creeping Flesh. Thank you to the listeners for filling in that particular blank for me. And much as I really wanted to embrace this because I thought the American rehash, the Hollywood rehash, was a bit of a travesty, I found it very, very hard to be bothered or interested by, or indeed, more importantly, scared by Wreck 2.
Exorcisty. Is that I-E or Y, would you think? With
why?
A hyphen or without?
No, Y.
It doesn't really exist as a word, though, does it?
Exorcist-esque.
But Wreck 2, the Michael Bolton of horror movies.
It is.
And then people can just work it out for themselves. Put that on the poster. And Andrew in Dulwich, after last week's programme, I immediately looked up Danny Dyer's anti-Cambodian rant. And very entertaining it was too. As an actor, it seems odd that Danny doesn't understand that just as in fiction, one tells a lie in order to reveal a deeper truth, so Mark's impersonation, while not being a direct frequency match of Danny's brogue, conveys the essence of a Dyer performance. As for Danny's threat to assault Mark's canister, it's obviously posturing on his part, although if he does visit the Kermode house, it might be judicious to throw a towel over the soda stream. And John in Newton Le Willows, I'm worried in case Dr. K disturbs his canister if he doffeth it too much, because you were doing a lot of doffing at the beginning of the programme. For the canister in question, as mentioned by Danny Dyer.
Oh!
That was a
I can't one. Be bothered anymore.
Is I can reveal Dr. K's whippy hair. It may interest you to know that Danny Dyer.
Oh!
Is suffering some Cockney-style grief with Channel 4 for dyeing his hair for a television drama, which he now insists is the reason his canister is thinning. He will soon be canister-less, unlike Dr. K, to whom Mr. Dyer called him a geezer. So there you go. I think that's all the Dyer correspondence that you possibly could want.
Would want.
Sex and the City 2, you might have seen the posters. You might be wondering whether Mark's going to like it. Just a reminder, as we did mention earlier to Gabby, you did say when you went to see the first one...
So and there don't go and see the first one, because if you do, you'll only encourage them to make another one. And, well, obviously...
They did.
They did, but loads of people... And this will be number one next week. And I should say right at the beginning of this, you're not going to get a rant about this, because it's one of those things like, you know... I mean, it's the parental thing about I'm not angry, I'm disappointed. I mean, it's... My expectations were low, and I have to say they were met. It's ghastly... and I've spent quite a lot of time in the last week trying to figure out exactly what it is that is so ghastly and putrid and vomit-inducing about Sex and the City 2. So essentially, as I said, if you went to see the first one, this is kind of your fault. It's about 146 minutes long, which is about the same length as 2001. And in 2001, as I've said before, Stanley Kubrick goes from the birth of mankind to the birth of a new species and, you know, and connection with the extraterrestrials. And in Sex and the City 2, it goes from a group of totally consumerist, obsessed caricatures who end up as a group of totally consumer-obsessed caricatures. Anyway, the plot, it starts with a big gay wedding, okay? And there is a big gay wedding, which they keep referring to as a gay wedding, so we mustn't call it a gay wedding, but it's so gay that apparently when this much gay energy is in the room, these are lines from the film, incidentally, Liza Minnelli will manifest. And so Liza Minnelli comes on and officiates at the wedding. And it's the kind of gag that you could only make if basically, you know, it's like gay men making jokes about gay men. I mean, to be honest with you, The whole thing about Sex and the City is it appears that it's what's the phrase? It's jumped the shark. It's gone from being about a group of women, which I'm reliably informed that the television series was, to basically being about a group of men in drag. That is what it is. And it sort of tells you this at the very beginning when they have the big gay wedding, which is an in joke, which if anybody else was making it, you go, I'm sorry, this is stereotypical and just not funny and crass, and would you stop doing it? So anyway, Liza Minnelli turns up because everything's so gay. Fine, this is the beginning of the film. Then we have some stuff meeting the characters again, and then one of them gets offered a first class ticket to Abu Dhabi and says, I'm going to take all my girlfriends with me. So they go on tour, and this of course is a plot device which is, you know, known from all movies that based on television series that run out of steam. The example that I was going to use, although somebody writing in has already mentioned it, is not Carry On Up the Khyber, which a lot of other people have mentioned, but is, in fact, Are You Being Served a Movie, in which they go to the Costa Plonka, and it's all the Mrs. Slocum, and, ooh, I'm wearing, you know, all that stuff. It is essentially that
film.
That
was Danny Dyer for a moment.
Yeah, it was. I think, actually, it's the same actor plays both roles. So that is what you get. And the central idea this time is that they are older, and therefore they are dealing with age, and... And here's a clip of them dealing with age.
Wow, that's a whole lot of health. How many you work in there?
44. I'm on the one-a-day Fruity Pebbles plant.
Women our age shouldn't joke about vitamins.
Women who are not our age shouldn't say women our age.
Well, one day, very soon, you will thank me. I am leading the way through the menopause maze with my vitamins, my melatonin sleep patches, my bioidentical estrogen cream, progesterone cream, a touch of testosterone.
She's the hormone whisperer.
I am. I've tricked my body into thinking it's younger.
I've tricked my body into thinking it's thinner. Spanx.
And I'm telling you, no hot flashes, no mood swings in my sex drive. It's right back to where it was.
Really? Hadn't heard.
So, I've tricked my body into thinking it's thinner. If any of you were any thinner, you wouldn't exist. And as has been pointed out by everybody, for a film which primarily consists of people sitting around eating food, they don't appear to have eaten at all. So there's been an awful lot written by women about just how grotesque a portrayal of women this is, that they are basically obsessed with their bodies, obsessed with husbands, obsessed with sex, obsessed with, you know, nothing other than that, obsessed with consumerism. There really isn't any, not much to add to that other than to say...
Is that a... What's wrong with that, then?
Because, basically, its entire portrayal of female liberation is the right to buy expensive shoes, OK? And I don't believe for one minute that these people are depictions of real women. I just don't. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't believe it. If there are, then I'm mistaken. I just don't. I mean, I don't believe that real people in the real world are as ghastly as this. However, I'd like to move this on slightly from this, from sex war politics to class war politics, which for me was the overbearing. I mean, I think that its portrayal of women in general is just horrible. I mean, you worried about Killer Inside Me, believe me. But it's the class war issue here, which is this, right? Firstly, you are meant to be engaged with these characters who are stinking wealthy and consumerist beyond your wildest dreams. The main one, the one played by Sarah Jessica Parker, appears to write books, right? Although we never actually see her. Every now and then she kind of sits down and does a little bit of fiddling around. She lives in an apartment with her husband, who, in order to be sort of funding this apartment, is probably an arms dealer. Well, it's never really discussed, you know, where all their money is coming from. And she gets cross with him because at one point he buys her a massive flat-screen television, and she's cross that he hasn't bought her a bit of jewellery. And then, because their relationship is a little bit on top of each other, she goes back to her other apartment, which they've just kept on. She has a whole other apartment. Okay, so they have one lavish apartment, massive television, huge amounts of wealth, massive amount of clothes, walk-in wardrobe that you could put a family in. Then she goes off to another apartment that she hasn't bothered to sell because we're all so wealthy. And then she moans and complains about how awful her life is and isn't this difficult, and I really have to get away. You know, I have to get away from all this. So point number one. Point number two.
So what was the point?
The point is, first, why do I care about this character? This is a character who has so much money, so much wealth, that actually having two apartments, she's still, oh God, so hard, so difficult, oh, I'm having problems with my relationship. The defining moment for me is she goes to this hotel, which is $22,000 a night, okay, but she's getting it on the free. And when they arrive, each one of them is given their own personal exotic flunky who then waits on them hand on foot.
You'd expect that for $22,000 a night, wouldn't you?
Yes, but at no point does anyone say, I'm sorry, this is just ghastly beyond belief, that it's horrible. Fine.
Is there a choice of films?
So what happens is that at one moment, the flunky who she has been given, points out that actually he can only go and see his wife once every couple of months because the airfare is expensive, right? And you expect this to be a moment when she suddenly realises that the ghastly wealth that she's living with has a consequence, that there are people around who have less money. But no, this is used as a moment so that she can go, oh yes, I have to be away from Mr. Big sometimes as well. Therefore, and so you're going, I can't believe you've just done this. You've gone, you stinkingly wealthy consumerist dripping with gold shoes, bloody, bloody, bloody. He doesn't have enough money to go and see. And what you've seen in this isn't horrible, staggering inequality of just corpulent, filthy lucre, but, oh yes, we both have the same issue, which is to do with being apart from our loved one. Point number one, OK?
This is the old trot at the barricades, isn't it?
I'm sorry, this was the point at which I started going, then comrades come rally. Sorry, OK? As for the rest of them...
What was that?
That's the Internationale. One of them is a lawyer, right, who is not treated well at work, so quits. At no point does anybody in her marriage say, what are you about the money? No, because that's not an issue, because obviously, which means one of two things. Either the money that she was earning was nothing at all, which is unlikely because she's a lawyer, or the money that she's earning is completely insignificant because they've got money coming out of their ears. They've got so money, who would possibly care? Another one is a woman who is a mother who has a full-time nanny assistant, but who still finds time to go and cry in the food cupboard because she's so oppressed
by having to do the childcare, and the child puts jammy hands on her vintage skirt. We're meant to sympathise. And then there's a moment of self-reflexiveness in which he says, oh, what on earth do people who don't have help do? Nod to the screen. The rest of us going, oh, the serfs. You know, if we were in a Sex and the City movie, we'd be the help. We'd be the serfs. We'd be the person opening the door. So all that stuff going on. Fine. Then there's the race relations issue, which is they go to a foreign country where people dress differently. The main character, the screamy one who's, you know, Samantha, I think her name is, who's all the time going on about her sex life, ends up throwing condoms at these people, saying, you know, I'm a woman, I have sex. This is meant to be the great liberating them. In fact, the main message of the woman is, I'm a woman, I buy shoes, I am a consumerist. But
She can throw her shoes.
The twist of the movie is that it turns out that under the burkas, you know, under the full dress, actually all those women are wearing designer Diors that the minute they get in the same room as all the sexy people, they go, oh, look, we're all just as vacuous and shallow and horrible and consumerist obsessed as the rest of you. So essentially the message of the film is this: feel sympathy for people who are disgustingly wealthy, and so disgustingly wealthy that they not only don't notice having a spare apartment, not only don't notice losing the income from a job, not only don't notice that one of the people that they're employing is so poor that he can only afford to go and see his wife once every 3 months. Not only that, but are also imperialist American pig dogs of the highest order when it comes to cultural imperialism. I mean, honestly, I tell you, it's one of those things you just go, this is a satire, right? This has to, and it's not to do the gender politics, as I said, I will leave that to women who have written much more, you know, authoritatively outraged commentaries about this than I have. I would refer you, incidentally, to In the Stranger, this column by Lindy West, I think it is. Many people have tweeted about this. I can't read any of it out because it's scorchingly rude. But it's, but on the class war politics, it is
the
most.
The
don't say it like that.
Well, you did say I'm not going to rant. Say I am not going to rant, and that was about 10 minutes ago.
It is consumerist pornography. It is an orgy of dripping, you know, just dripping wealth that made me want to be sick.
Well, you know, as many listeners have said, if that wasn't a rant, then what is? I had the misfortune to watch Sex in the City this morning with my girlfriend. While it was not the awful estrogen fest that the first one was, it showed clearly that Michael Patrick King badly needs to hire an editor that subscribes to the Good Doctor's philosophy of 90 minutes or less. 2.5 hours felt like days, with scene after scene filled with nothing but pointless waffle. A lot more of that. Michelle Duffy was forced to go and see SATC2 last night and duly prepared for the ordeal with the help of red wine. Should have predicted the stereotypes and cultural ignorance that would ensue in the Middle East on seeing the begorra top of the morning Irish nanny, which got a collective groan from the entire audience, which was full of SATC fanatics. I don't know what was worse, the stereotype of the culturally ignorant American or the stereotypes of the Middle East.
No, they both. It's equal opportunities offensiveness.
And this one from Peter Griffin, BAHDIP IT, Dublin. Dr. K said we wouldn't get a rant, but we did. And without the benefit of actually having seen the movie, I can only agree with him. By the way, it seems that the idea of them going to the Middle East has been ripped off from Omid Jalili's sketch Sheikhs and the City, and this rant has just got better. Thank you for making my day. Lots more where that came from.
I tell you about a film that's good.
Yeah, so when you've seen that, get in touch with us, send us a text, send us an email, get on Twitter, just to make Mark's day. And as you say, it'll be number one next week.
I can't believe the pleasure you're taking in torturing me with this.
Well, I just thought it might be quite fun.
Yeah.
Just to go and see it and come back and report on it.
The Time That Remains is the new film by Ilya Suleiman, and his previous meditations on Israel-Palestine relations include Chronicle of a Disappearance and Divine Intervention, both of which I know you have seen, Simon.
What was that?
No. Okay, so this is the story of the true... inspired by the true story of his father, apparently inspired by...
I think they're next on my list.
Yeah, apparently inspired by the memoirs of his father, Fuad. And the story is that at the beginning, the father is a radical who is... This is during the beginning of Israel moving into this area. He's a radical. He's supplying arms. He is arrested, beaten up, left for dead. Later on, we see him now a withdrawn man who is greying and has produced a son who turns out later on to be the director. And it is essentially a meditation on you know, warring cultures, warring territories, life under occupation. The interesting thing about it is this. It has a very droll sense of comedy. An awful lot of people have referred to the comedy as being a Tati-esque or occasionally Keaton. I mean, personally, I would say the deadpan comedy is closer to Chaplin. I used to be a real, you know, I had a problem with Chaplin, didn't get Chaplin at all. Funnily enough, watching this, I do see an awful lot of Chaplin's deadpan pathos in it. There are some wonderfully black, dark comic vignettes. There's one recurrent theme of a neighbour who is so appalled by having been taken over by this, you know, alien culture that he keeps going out to the street and pouring petrol over himself and threatening to set fire to himself, but he can't ever light a match, which sounds like it ought to be incredibly grisly, but it's actually very, you know, droll and deadpan comic. There's one lovely scene in which a tank follows somebody making a phone call in the street. As they walk backwards and forwards, the tank turns its turret left and right. It's funny, interestingly, with Lebanon out in cinemas at the moment, to see that from outside done as a sort of, as a, you know, blackly comic moment was rather strange and rather moving. It's beautifully shot. Some people have said that they're concerned that the film doesn't seem to say anything other than this situation is unnatural and unusual and very, very hard to deal with. I thought there was much more in it than that. I thought it was very melancholic, beautiful to look at. Occasionally the visuals reminded me of David Lynch, and I was really quite impressed by the film. And I have to say, for me, it was my film of the week. I thought it was something that actually was doing something interesting with a difficult situation and attempting to deal with a difficult situation in a way that was, you know, that was both comedic and profoundly sad and melancholy. Other thing I want to mention very quickly is The Losers Out this week, which is this adaptation of a comic book which has now been sort of watered down to some extent to a 12 certificate movie. And the story is that there's a group of special ops guys. They are sent in by the CIA to do some dirty work. At the beginning of the film, they are sent into a village to be the sighting for an air raid. They realise there are kids in the village. They say, you can't do the air raid. The people say, we're going to do the air raid anyway. So they save the kids in a school bus. The kids then get into a helicopter, which meets a sticky end. Our guys, the losers, realise that the sticky end was intended for them. And they
just
then...
the whole film?
No, this is the beginning of the film, right? And they then have to find their way back, both into respectability and fight a battle with the head honcho, who, of course, is amassing arms, played by Jason Patrick. It's not very good. It's not very bad. It's just, I wasn't sure who it was for. I don't think it'll play to the hardcore audience. I think it's too grown up for the young audience, too young for the grown up audience. But it was interesting for me primarily because Jason Patrick, well, of course, you know who Jason Patrick is. Jason Patrick is Jason Miller's son. So he is son of The Exorcist. And in the past, Jason Patrick has done some very interesting stuff, particularly After Dark, My Sweet, which was an adaptation of a Jim Thompson novel. We were talking about Thompson earlier on with Michael Winterbottom, which for my money, directed by James Foley, was one of the finer Jim Thompson adaptations. I was kind of disappointed to see Jason Patrick reduced to doing this, but what he does as the caricature villain is the most interesting stuff in the film.
Don't forget, the podcast is available and you can subscribe to that. Are you exhausted?
I am.
Because it wasn't a rant, was it? It was just you explaining your...
I kept a lid on it.
...membership of the Communist Party. Now, this from Mary Francis. My 18-month-old is now running around copying Mark's Danny Dyer speak. Please, please don't do any more Danny Dyer impressions. My brain is melting.
Okay.
Remind us of the movie of the week, then.
The Time That Remains.
Will we be able to see it?
Yes, you will. Go and see it in the local cinema near you. Go to your art house cinema. Go to your rep cinemas.
And let's all see Sex and the City in an entertainment.
Don't do that!
And then tweet and tell us.
Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode and check out my blog, Kermode Uncut.